Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Thanks, Rick, and hello, everyone. I'm certainly privileged to be able to do this workshop today. It's a little different format from what I have used before in that it's all audio and I can't see my my audience, and I regret that I can't see your smiling faces or your faces of disagreement, as the case may be. But I trust that in the question and answer period, if you have any disagreements or questions or whatever, you can let me know what they are. As implied by the title of this workshop, it is intended for managers at all levels. Sometimes folks think that management is only the role of the administrator, the person who's at the head of the organization. But in reality, management occurs at all levels of the organization. There are many managers, whether they're called supervisors, or whether they're called administrators, or whether they're called managers or directors, or whatever the title may be. And whatever their position title, they need to be able to employ various administrative principles to carry out these roles. And this is true in secular agencies and church-related agencies as well. But for social workers who are Christians and are managing, whether that agency is a secular agency or a church-related agency, managers such as this should be able to apply administrative principles that reflect their Christian faith, in my opinion. And certainly, if you are in a management position and you're carrying out your management functions, and in doing so, this is in conflict with what you believe as a Christian, this is a great deal of stress for you. So I hope that we can today identify not only various principles of management from the literature and from hopefully from experience, but also that we can talk about how these are reflective of what we believe as Christians. So Rick mentioned the experience that I've had, and I'll be drawing upon this experience in my presentation today and drawing upon some of the literature. But I do want to stress up front, if you try to follow the what you are sent, the topics to be covered, you're going to go crazy, because these are topics to be covered, but not an outline that I will actually follow. I tried to put together something that would follow this outline, but it just didn't work. The approach that I'm going to use is to present a number of maxims or rules or principles of management in order. And in doing so, I want to try to integrate all the content that are covered by these topics: the theoretical frameworks, organization and environment, leadership styles, exercising authority, and so forth. You see them on the screen or on the material that you were sent earlier. I promise you, we will cover all of these, but it will not be in a 1, 2, 3, 4 outline fashion. That just doesn't suit the approach that I want to use in this presentation. With that said, let me begin with the first maxim for managers, and that is, number one, recognize that you as a manager set the tone at the top of that organization or at the level at which you function as manager. This is really like a fact of nature. If you see herds of animals, there's a leader, and the others follow the example of the leader. Certainly true in families. The tone that is set by the leader of the family, be that the father or the mother or whoever, the tone will influence the way the others react and the way they feel, the way they respond. And it's certainly true in social groups. All of us have been members of social groups that are affirming and uplifting. And unfortunately, we've been members of social groups that are negative, social groups that reflect the tone of a negative leader. So the the person at the top of the organization, in my opinion, sets the tone for everything that happens from his or her level down. And again, if you're the manager at a mid-level position, you reflect a certain tone, a certain attitude, a certain philosophy, and that affects the people who work beneath you in the supervisory scheme. And in saying this, I'm reminded that Christ is the head of the church. And I like the old bumper stickers that say, "What would Jesus do?" It's a simplistic slogan, but I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I would ask you, as a manager, to reflect upon that principle. What would Jesus do? And to do so, let me throw out a question at this point. What were some of the adjectives you would use to describe the characteristics of Jesus Christ, some of his personal attributes that would define who he was and what he was as a leader? It's open for questions, comments.
If you have a comment or question, if you can just hit star six on your keypad. That way you'll be able to be heard by Frank and by the whole group. Again, star six.
Okay. Your responses.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loudly and clearly.
Good. I was just going to say that a characteristic I've noted is that he always did things in a loving manner with the motivation of love, but it wasn't necessarily weak. I mean, he was firm in what he stood for and what was important to him, but he delivered the message with love.
Very good. Loving, strong, holding to what he believed. Other characteristics of Christ that we can apply. Well, what about nurturing when we think of Christ? Do we not think of Christ as a nurturing leader? And what about forgiving? Remember how he was able to forgive the people who betrayed him. He was a forgiving leader. There are many other characteristics of Christ, of course, which we should aspire to emulate. But if we're going to set the tone at our level of management, we could do much worse than to follow the example of Christ in trying to become the kind of Christian that he would have us to be. So the first maxim is recognize that you set the tone or the level of the organization for which you are in charge.
Frank, if I could just mention a couple people via the chat feature. Jan mentioned that Jesus anticipated the needs of other persons, and Stephen mentioned that he was an exemplary mentor. So that's some other feedback in response to your question.
Excellent. Very good. Thank you, Jan. He was indeed a mentor. And he set the example through not only what he taught, but through his personal example. Okay, the second maximum grows out of that. And this is where we're going to get into some theoretical literature. The second maxim is have a positive philosophy or positive view of the world and people. A writer in the management literature by the name of Douglas McGregor did a lot of research, developed a lot of theory on the subject of leadership, and he identified through his research two basic types of leaders. The first one he referred to as Theory X managers. And these people, quite frankly, are rather negative, in my opinion. They tend to see others as being inherently bad. In their philosophy of management, they think that freedom should be limited. They believe that external controls need to be put in place to keep their employees in check. They tend to view employees as lazy and irresponsible. Theory X managers believe that people are competitive and that they're not naturally inclined to be cooperative. And Theory X managers believe that human beings are basically resistant to change. So if they believe this about people, then that has implications for what these managers would do in their role as administrators. They believe that this type of manager believes that there has to be a lot of rules to be followed. The rules have to be very explicit, very clear. They believe that they need to direct their employees and oversee what they do. And when they don't do their job properly, they need to be punished for it. Theory X managers believe that they must modify the behaviors of their employees to meet the needs of the organization. And as you might imagine, Theory X managers micromanage more than any other type. They want to oversee, not only oversee what the people below them do, but they tend to oversee the work that's done all the way up and down the line. In contrast to this, we have what McGregor referred to as Theory Y managers. And these are managers who are more positive in their outlook towards human beings. Theory Y managers believe that mistakes are natural because all of us make mistakes. And that usually these mistakes occur not because people are bad or trying not to do good, but that they're reactions to conditions. Theory Y managers believe, they honestly believe that human beings are responsible, that they are self-directed, and that they're motivated. Theory Y managers believe that the people who work for them want to grow and they want to develop. And they believe that their employees are concerned first and foremost about the good of the group, the good of the organization. Now, you might imagine, given this view of human beings, the manager who is a Theory Y manager tries to create opportunities for the people who work for him or her to blossom. They don't have these set rules or very many strict rules that the employees follow. Instead, whenever possible, they want the employees to develop the rules and the strategies and the tactics for themselves. And they want to motivate people to do what they can to achieve their own goals because they believe that insofar as their employees achieve their goals, this will also benefit the good of the organization. Now, I want to throw a question out at this point. We have the Theory X manager and the Theory Y manager. What is the Christian perspective on human beings? Is the Christian perspective that human beings are basically bad or basically good? Basically trustworthy or basically untrustworthy? And let's hear your responses on that. I'll throw it up for questions or comments.
Again, if you have questions or comments, hit star 6 on your keypad. Or give us a response to the chat feature on the screen. So either star 6 or chat feature on the screen. Thanks.
Frank, while folks are gathering their thoughts, one initial response that comes to me to the question that you are asking is that I think our Christian faith recognizes both aspects. Both are having been created in God's image and so have amazing potential. Amazing potential for good, but that also that there's been a jarring disruption to God's intent and our design through decisions we've made, and so there's also a good deal about who we are that's off the mark. Some elements of each is sort of embraced by our faith and our understanding of our faith.
Very good. Thanks, Rick.
Let me just read a couple of other comments that came in via chat. Barbara says, as a Christian, you look at people through Christ and would see them as positive, forgiven, and loving. Angela from Texas says, I think we are born sinful, but able to be reborn with a better propensity for doing the right thing more often.
Barbara from St. Louis says that however the reality of sin that exists, people don't always do what is right. And Kim from Rockville says, good point, the potential for good is ongoing, but fallen persons have ongoing struggle with the need to become more like Christ.
Very good.
Those are the comments that came in.
Thank you. I agree with everything that has been said. Because we are all sinners. We've all sinned and fallen short of the will of God. We are fallen from grace. And at the same time, this is true. God does see the good in all of us, and God calls us. And again, we can reflect back to the example of Christ. I think first of the woman at the well, when Christ saw her. He didn't just see a sinner. He saw a human being, a person with potential, a person who was flawed, and perhaps because of circumstances that were beyond her control. But he saw a human being with potential, and he reached out for her. Think of Jesus' experience with Peter. Peter was a sinner. He denied Christ, for heaven's sakes, even after he knew him. And yet, Christ continued to believe in him. I think of the example of Paul, persecutor of Christians. Here was a person who was considered himself the chief among sinners. And yet, he was able to have literally the road to Damascus experience. And in this epiphany, he saw his mistakes. He saw his sins. He saw himself for who he was and what he was, and he was able to use his life for the good of God and for the will of God. So this is our perspective as managers. The people who work for us are human beings just like we are. They've sinned. That doesn't mean that they're all bad. That doesn't mean that there's not potential for good. That doesn't mean that they're not trying to do good. And this, let's expand on this theme a little bit then. This, which picks up, as Rick said, both perspectives, Theory X management and Theory Y management. Our belief as Christians teaches us that we can believe in people. This leads to the third maxim I would suggest to you, and that is trust people to do the right thing. Believe in people. And this, I guess, applies not only to the people who work for you, but people for whom you work, your superiors. Sometimes we can get rather paranoid and think that the person who's supervising us doesn't understand and that they do not have our goodwill at heart, that they're perhaps doing something that is malevolent. And we have a rather sad attitude sometimes, and we can even get paranoid about it. But this can make our lives rather miserable. If we believe and trust in people to do the right thing, we'll be much happier. And this is also true for the people, not only for whom we work, but the people who work with us and for us, the people whom we supervise. It doesn't mean they're 100% good or that you can naively believe only the good. I suppose there's a continuum that all of us fall on. It's certainly true with me that some days I'm not as bad as I am on other days. But I can only speak for myself in knowing that I strive to be what Christ would have me to be. And we want other people to give us the benefit of the doubt. And perhaps as managers, that is what we should do, is give other people the benefit of the doubt, as Theory Y managers are wont to do, to believe that they do have the good of the organization at heart, that they want to achieve for the company or the organization, the system for which they work. All right, this leads to a fourth maxim, which I will lift up to you, and that is managers should strive to create a nurturing environment. Nurturing environment. When I think of a nurturing environment, the first thing that comes to my mind is a family. And I would ask you another question at this point. Then, so far as a family is concerned, as a nurturing group, what are the things that a family does that are nurturing? What are the characteristics of a nurturing family? It's open for question. Comment.
So again, star six, if you'd like to be heard or make a comment or question on the chat feature. Frank Heather from Dallas says that nurturing family allows members to question without judgment.
Very good. Thanks, Heather.
And Shirley from Missouri mentions that families provide a sense of belonging. Jan mentioned that families create a safe place. And Angela from Arlington, Texas, said that families feed each other literally, emotionally, and otherwise.
Very good. All very true. And these are exactly the kinds of characteristics we would like to create in the organization. And as an administrator, it is our responsibility to create such a nurturing environment, an environment in which people feel like they belong, in which they feel like they can be honest and forthright with each other, and they will not be shunned because of that, an environment in which they care for each other, and hopefully an environment in which there is an esprit de corps, an excitement about what the organization is about. All right, this leads to a fifth maxim. As you can see, these tend to follow, to flow one from the other. The fifth maxim is that the managers, administrators, should encourage all employees to develop their individual strengths. We learned in 1 Corinthians 12:1 and following that we all have gifts of one type or another. And this is certainly true of the people who work with you and for you. They all have special gifts, special strengths, special abilities. And as a manager, just like in the family, we should encourage them to develop these strengths, to use these gifts for the good of the organization. And then to be creative in doing so, to exercise initiative. This is the way organizations grow, as individuals pitch in, everybody doing what they do best. And that it flows from this, as people exercise their special talents, they should be rewarded for their initiative, word and indeed. All of us want to hear it said, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." Let me bring some more literature in at this point. Frederick Herzberg was one of the famous writers about motivational theory in management. He did his research in the 1950s and 60s and published a great deal of research on how you motivate people. And he developed what he calls the two-factor theory of motivation. He said you can't just rank the things that motivate people to work for the organization and to achieve for the organization along a scale, because there are basically two types of motivators, two types of factors. One are what he called the hygienic factors. And these are things that must be present in the organization for a person to feel good about their work and to feel motivated at all. And these things, like having a decent level of pay, having other benefits that are available, such as some vacation time and some sick leave time, this type of thing. These are hygienic factors. But beyond that, there are other factors, Herzberg recognized, that truly do motivate people to do more and more and more. Now, you might think one of these might be praise, and it is. That is one of the motivators. People do like to be praised. They do like to hear it said, "Well done." People are motivated to a certain extent by increased pay. A lot of folks, when I ask this question in workshops and say, what is the number one motivator, will say that pay, remuneration. And while it does motivate people to achieve, that is not such a great motivator. The thing that Herzberg found that motivates people to achieve more than anything else is to give them a challenging task to perform. something that will stretch them to the limits of their ability, and then for them to achieve that task successfully. People feel good when they do that. And all of us can relate to that. Have you ever had a test you had to take, or a paper you had to write, or a speech you had to give, or something that was very challenging to you, and you did it, and you did it well? The reward was in the experience, wasn't it? And that is what we should do with our employees. Recognize their gifts, recognize their special abilities, and then give them the opportunity to shine. And if they are able to do that and to do something for the organization through the use of their gifts, whatever they may be, this is the most motivating thing we can do. All right, let me move to the sixth maxim. That is, we should recognize and encourage leadership in others. Now, as a manager, you are a leader. But there are other leaders in the organization. You know, we talk in the literature about formal and informal leadership. And sometimes the informal leadership is more powerful than the formal leadership. And again, we can think of examples from Bible and the New Testament examples of the different types of leaders. If you look at the disciples that Jesus called, for example, that was the most unlikely bunch of people in the world, it would seem, to be disciples. I mean, look at the backgrounds, look where they came from, and yet Christ saw that each of them had special gifts that they could use. He saw that each of them had the ability to provide different kinds of leadership, and he chose them to be his disciples. And there are different kinds of leaders today that we can identify who work with us. In the 1940s, I guess it was, a famous writer on leadership in management literature by the name of Kirk Lewin developed, or rather identified, that there are three types of leaders, and I'm sure most of you have heard about this or read about this, studied about this, and they are the authoritarian leader, the laissez-faire leader, and the democratic leader. The famous example that he cited was the first study he did on leadership and to identify these types, and this was involving school children. They were given a task to do something artsy, some kind of craft they had to produce. I think they were making face masks or some such thing. And he assigned each of these groups a different type of leader. The first group had the rather authoritarian or autocratic leader, and this was a person who gave clear expectations and told the kids exactly what they had to do. They didn't have to make any decisions, and he turned them loose. Second type of leader was the laissez-faire, or the delegative type of leader. The leader of that group of children just didn't make any demands. He basically said, well, here's the material. If you want to make face masks, go for it. And didn't put any kind of expectations upon them. And the third type of leader that of these groups was the democratic leader. This is sometimes known today as participative management or participative leadership. This leader offered guidance to the children, and he encouraged them to make their own decisions about how they wanted to make the face masks, and how many they wanted to make, and what they would look like. Now, you can imagine what the results of these different types of leadership were, and they've been borne out in many, many, many studies with all kinds of people since then. The authoritarian leader had a group that made a lot of face masks. They produced a whole lot, but the kids were not very happy. They just did what they were supposed to do, and they became bossy and complaining. They just were not very happy. Second type leadership, that group of children did not produce much at all, and they were the most unhappy of all the three groups. And of course, as you might imagine, the democratically led group of kids produced the most face masks. They were the most creative. They were they were the kind of they exhibited the kind of work that one would hope kids would do at that level of ability. But as I said, this research has been replicated time and time again, and we all have experienced this type of leadership. We know that the authoritarian leader, and there are examples in history, we know that the authoritarian leader can get things done. The authoritarian leader often has devoted followers, as we've seen by some famous people in history. And the authoritarian leader can establish and maintain order. But by the same token, that is not the kind of leadership style that any of us would want to have, and it's not the type of leadership style that we would aspire to. So in all of our work, there are people who have leadership abilities. Some of them may tend to be more along the authoritarian lines, some along the laissez-faire lines, and some along the democratic lines. But we should encourage them to use their leadership skills in the organization, because there is a time and a place for every type of leadership. For example, if you have a task that needs to be done quickly and there's no time for mutual decision-making or group decision-making, you may have to be a little authoritarian, or you may have to assign a person to be head of that task to be done who's authoritarian in nature, someone who can be more task-oriented. On the other hand, if you're calling for something that that requires a great deal of creativity and a lot of input, you may just want to be more laissez-faire, or assign a leader to that group who's more laissez-faire. The best example of this I can think of is the work that was done. Excuse me, I'm getting a call on the line. I hope you can't hear that. The best example I can think of this is during the Affordable Care Act, when it was necessary to bring in some experts to try to correct the problem that was existing with the system. And I can just imagine, I've pictured in my own mind getting all these geniuses in one room, these people who are experts in the area of technology. I don't think they would take very well to having a supervisor tell them exactly what to do, but if they were allowed to work together and have their input individually, and to come up with solutions to the problem, they could get it done. And apparently, that's what happened. They had a leader, but I think the leader allowed each of them to be creative in his or her own way. All right, let's move to the seventh maxim for management now. That is to foster a spirit of cooperation, teamwork, and mutual support. I like the old saying, lead, follow, or get out of the way. You know, hopefully there are people who can be leaders. Hopefully you are a leader. But every leader must have followers. And as we go back to the previous maxim of leading, we can encourage the people who work for us and with us to be leaders. But if they don't want to lead, help them know how to follow. And if there are people who just refuse to follow, then maybe they just need to stand aside and let others do the work. But foster a sense of cooperation, teamwork, and mutual support. Our eighth maxim for managers is to give credit to others. Give credit where credit is due. There's a famous saying, and it's sometimes attributed to Einstein and sometimes to Harry Truman and sometimes to Ronald Reagan, but I think it actually goes back beyond any of them, that says no limit of what you can achieve as long as you allow others to get the credit for it. But this is what we should strive to do as leaders. When people do a good thing, let them get the credit for it. The converse of that is true too. Never, ever steal credit or take credit from others. That is one of the worst things you can do. It destroys your credibility. If someone else does a job, and does it well, and you as a manager try to take credit for what someone else has done. People see through it, and they see through you. The ninth principle of management, which flows from this, is to exercise authority appropriately. Going back to what was said earlier, there are different types of management styles, different ways of exercising leadership, and sometimes the situation does call for more authority. And certainly, authority comes with the position that you hold. And some folks have a lot of trouble with a mantle of authority. And this is often true of social workers. They don't want to be in charge. They have a hard time with authority. But sometimes we simply have to, in our role as authority persons, we have to exert authority. Sometimes we do have to be, even to the point of being autocratic. And maybe it's kind of like being parents. As parents, we have to be authority figures. We can't just have a democratic arrangement with our young children and let them make all the decisions. We have to exert authority from time to time. And this is what managers need to do when the occasion calls for it. I had the fortune, or good fortune or bad fortune, depending on your point of view, of going to a school of social work that was a functional school, the University of North Carolina. At that point, there were two schools of social work that were functional in nature. One was Chapel Hill, and the other was the University of Pennsylvania. The others were known as more of the diagnostic-oriented schools, using more of the Freudian approach. So there was this battle going on in social work education back in those days, and this was a long time ago. There was a battle going on about which is the better approach. But one of the things I appreciated about the functional school is the value of limits, setting limits, establishing limits with clients, and holding the clients to those limits. And when that is done, the client is able to come to terms with whatever the issue may be and to accept the reality of this and move on with his or her life. And that's kind of the way it has to be in management sometimes. There have to be limits. There have to be boundaries. There have to be rules. There have to be some expectations that are clearly articulated. And that's what your role is as a manager. All right, let me move to the 10th maxim for managers. That is, insist on excellence. Set high standards and expect others to follow them. Don't tolerate poor quality. You know, if you expect a job to be done and it's not done well, you have a responsibility to see to it that person who did the job poorly is able to improve his or her work. You can't tolerate poor quality work. And whatever the reason for it may be, it's your job as a manager to help the person understand that you do have certain levels of quality you expect, and to help them understand how they can better fulfill those expectations. And sometimes it might be something like a continuing education. Sometimes it might be having a mentor, someone who can in the organization who can help guide them. Sometimes it might be putting them with a group of people who are working on a particular task so they can learn from each other. But I think the best way to insist on excellence is to model it yourself. Never let anything come out of your office that you've worked on that is not of highest quality. I think that we tend to get sloppy sometimes in our writing today because of technology. I think that we've learned to use shortcuts, shorthand in our writing, and we know we can send something out in a text message or even in an email that's poorly written, and it's okay. But I think with that, we're losing some of the skill in writing that we need to display as managers, or not just as managers, but anyone in an organization. So insist upon excellence and model it in your own behavior. The 11th principle of management accept the fallibility of others. I was talking a moment ago about people who work with you and for you making mistakes in their work. Well, that's to be expected. Nobody's perfect. And again, this is biblical, that all of us have sinned. All of us have our weaknesses. All of us have our shortcomings. And we can't expect anything more than that from others. The people who work for us are going to make mistakes. But the important thing is to see the whole person and not just to see what they have done wrong or the mistake that they have made. To see the whole person and believe that they want to be better and do better and give them the opportunity to do so. This leads to the 12th maxim for managers, and that is judge the person's work. Do not judge the person. Now, all of us as managers have to do evaluations, and when I first became a manager, I despised doing evaluations until I learned a different approach to it, and that was in evaluating an employee's performance, you're doing just that. You are evaluating their performance. You're not evaluating them. And as social workers, we know to use the strengths perspective, not judging the other person, judging what they've done wrong, but looking at what they've done right and building upon what they have done right. The 13th principle of management, or maxim for managers, blows from that. And that is, don't assign blame. It really doesn't matter, you know, who is at fault in a situation. The problem that is at hand is what needs to be corrected, not the other person. Don't assign blame. It doesn't matter. And nothing makes you as a caller than to assign blame for someone else. And be willing with this, be willing to accept your responsibility in the situation. Usually when problems happen in an organization, it's not just the fault of one person. And if it is someone else's fault, ask yourself the question, what did I as a manager do or fail to do to prevent that from happening? The important thing is, don't assign blame. It doesn't matter. All it does is make you seem smaller. The 14th maxim flows from that, and that is, accept your own fallibility. Be humble. You know, in spite of the fine introduction that Rick presented a while ago, I want you to know that I am nothing but a sinner saved by grace, and I know that. I realize that I have a long ways to go in trying to be what Christ would have me to be. I realize as a manager my fallibility. In fact, I don't know of any administrator I have ever worked with or for who's ever reached such an exalted stage of personal development that they have no character flaws. Many of them are jealous, can engage in jealousy. Many of them have tempers. I've had many managers who have a hard time controlling their anger. Some managers have ulterior motives to what they do. In fact, some of them just make stupid decisions sometimes. And I'm probably guilty of all those things, but the important thing is for the manager to accept his or her own fallibility. If we can keep and remain humble, if we can recognize the fact that we have sinned and come short of the glory of God, this helps us to view other people in a more clear-eyed perspective. The 15th maxim I would cite to you flows from that. That is, learn from your mistakes. Don't just make mistakes, but learn from them. I had a friend one time who said that his favorite file in his desk was his mistake file. And he literally recorded his mistakes that he had made. Whenever he fouled up and did something wrong, he would write it down and say to himself, what can I learn from that? How can I learn from that mistake? And he did learn from it. The 16th maxim I would lift up to you is to be fair and objective. Even when you disagree with other people, even when they disagree with you, try to be fair and objective. And even when you don't like the other person, try to be fair and objective. And there will be people you don't like. Maybe they're there for a reason. And I can cite a personal example on this. Remember, earlier in the presentation, we talked about trying to cultivate a nurturing environment. Shortly after I became dean, and I should say I'd been on the faculty as a faculty member before I became dean, but shortly after I became dean, I tried to inculcate that notion of family. And in one of the first faculty meetings, I said that I wanted us to function as a family and to care for each other and nurture each other and so on. Well, I had a friend who was sort of a naysayer anyway, and he took umbrage at that, and he thought, well, how naive can you be? You know, this is a bunch of competitive faculty members who are all striving to be tenured and promoted, and they're trying to achieve on their own, and he just didn't buy into that. He was a naysayer, and he remained a naysayer, and I never did make him feel like he was part of the family as I wanted him to be. But what I learned over time was that he was like the deviant brother on the family. You know, he was going to engage in behaviors that were troublesome to me and troublesome to others on the faculty. But he served a valuable role. He would say things to me that nobody else would say. He would bring up examples of what I was doing wrong that I needed to correct, and sometimes I agreed with him, sometimes I didn't agree with him. But he kept me straight. That was a perfect example of how God can put someone in our way who can teach us something that we need to know. 17th maxim for managers is seize opportunities to manage conflict. There will be conflict. I don't care how nurturing the environment may be that you create. I don't care how wonderful the organization is. I don't care if it's a secular or a church-related organization. There will be conflict. That's inevitable because we're humans. But we should not just ignore conflict when it occurs. We shouldn't just pretend that it's not there, but we should use conflict as a means for change and growth. Again, personal example on this. When our college was going through a review for reaffirmation of accreditation, we were changing the curriculum. And we had some faculty members who were on both sides of a particular curriculum issue, and they had strong feelings about it. One of them wanted to see it one way and one another. So we were in no rush about this. I did not have to be an authoritarian type. I could allow them to take their time to solve the issue at hand. And my response was to say, okay, get together. Let's get together and see if we can air these differences and work them out. And then I did something beyond that. I assigned a person who was a process person. She was not a task type leader, but she was a process type leader. I assigned her to be in charge of that change, of that process. And this group met, and they disagreed, and they fought, and they fussed, but they ultimately came to a compromise that everybody embraced, and the curriculum was stronger and stronger because of it. That's the example of how conflict should be managed. If you allow people, if you believe that people are good and they have the good of the organization at hand, they will the problem solve in just that manner. All right, let's talk about the 18th principle of management. The 18th principle is to realize that some problems will not go away. Just as there'll be conflict in any organization, there will be some problems that just will not go away. There are things about administration that I never did like doing, but they were part of the turf. And I'm sure there are parts of administration that you face every day that you don't like. Maybe it's preparing a budget. Maybe it's some of the reports and paperwork you have to do, or dealing with bureaucracy. You know, for most people, what it is personnel issues, dealing with personnel issues. But whatever the issue may be, there are certain aspects of the job that just will not go away. Recognize that. That's reality. Recognize it. Move on from there. All right, the 19th principle of management is this. Don't take yourself too seriously. When I retired as dean about 12 years ago, I worried about what was going to happen to the college. It's not that I felt like I was the greatest leader in the world, but I worried about what would happen to the college. That was so arrogant on my part. The college has been there ever since. They've had 3 deans since then, all of whom have done a good job, and the school is going on just fine without me, thank you, ma'am. And that's true of all of us. We're not indispensable. The agency in which you work can't exist without you. Your work can be done whether you're there or not. Keep that in mind, that don't take yourself too seriously. And with that goes the idea of putting problems in perspective. Sometimes a problem can occur in our work and it just seems totally insurmountable. We may be blown away by it. But if we can back away from it and put it in perspective, that helps. When I was a child, I used to stump my toe occasionally or get a bite from some insect or hurt myself playing or what have you. My grandmother, who lived with us part of the time, had a saying that irritated me at the time, and I wondered why she said it, but she'd say, "Oh, it'll go away before you get married." Well, I didn't appreciate that because I had no intentions of getting married at that young age, and I didn't know what she meant. But then I finally understood. She was saying to me in her way, put that problem in perspective. It'll go away. The world's not going to come to an end. And if you learn not to take yourself too seriously, it helps to maintain a sense of being human. Learn to laugh at yourself. Learn to look at your mistakes and laugh at something you did that was foolish or something you said that was embarrassing. Just don't take yourself too seriously. And the 20th and finally maxim for managers I would raise to you today is take care of yourself. Administration is stressful at any level. Managers burn out just like other people do. The turnover rate is extremely high in management positions. Some people think they would like to be managers and they try it for a while and they decide it's not for them. Many people, like me, were thrust into management positions without really aspiring towards that. When I was named interim dean of the college, I had no desire to be a dean, but the former dean left and I was asked to be interim dean and decided I kind of like that. But some people get into management and they decide they don't like it. That's all right. There's an old story on that, and it's about a fellow who worked for a potato company where they would bring the potatoes after they were harvested from the field, and they would wash them and put them on a conveyor belt and divide them by size and grade them and then put them in bags. Well, he started off as a washer of the potatoes. It's his job, when the potatoes came in from the field, to wash the potatoes and get off all the dirt and make them as clean as possible and throw away the bad ones and then put them on the conveyor belt. Well, he did such a good job that his boss decided that he needed a promotion. So he promoted him to the conveyor belt, where his job every day would be to stand by the conveyor belt and divide the potatoes. Big potato, little potato, smallest potato. And three categories, all day long. He didn't have to worry about getting his hands wet and getting cold from washing those potatoes. All he had to do was divide the potatoes. Well, after 2 days of doing that, he went to his boss and said, I'm going to have to quit. And his boss said, why? I gave you this promotion. You're making a lot more money. The work's not nearly as hard as the work you're doing before. He said, well, there are just too many decisions to make with this job. And maybe that's the way it is with management, because part of your work is decision-making, day in, day out. And some people really just don't care for that type of work. And that's all right. As I said earlier, everybody has their own gifts, and management may or may not be what you want to do with your life. But if you do believe that management is for you at any level, whatever it may be, there are some things you can do to perhaps alleviate some of the stress that comes along with it. First of all, I would say learn to delegate. Don't try to do everything yourself. Allow others to take on some of the responsibilities. Don't micromanage, but let others have responsibility for making some of the decisions and for carrying out some of the tasks. The second thing I believe you can do to deal with the stress of the job of management is to make sure you get plenty of R&R, rest and relaxation. You probably have heard the old saying that no person on their deathbed ever said, golly, I wish I'd spent more time at the office. So take time to be with your family. Take time to relax. Take time to regroup. Engage in renewal, self-renewal. The third thing I would suggest to you to take care of yourself is to find strength and serenity in your faith and fellowship. This is a resource that Christian managers have that people who are non-believers simply do not have. All of us who are Christians have had situations in life when we had to turn to God and say, God, I just don't know what to do with this situation. Please help me handle it. We've always found a ready resource there. So do not hesitate to turn to your faith and your fellowship. In church, with your friends, your like believers, you can find strength. And finally, and relatedly, a resource that you have available is prayer. Pray regularly. And I think there's a model prayer that sort of encapsulates a lot of the things we've been saying today. And that's a prayer that I'm sure many of you have heard before. It's the Serenity Prayer by Reinhold Niebuhr. The first few lines of that are often referred to as the Serenity Prayer that are used in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the prayer is much longer than that. And if you would allow me to read that prayer. God, give me the grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed. Courage to change the things which should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, taking as Jesus did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, but trusting that you will make all things right if I surrender to your will. Reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with you forever in the next. Amen. As I said, I think the Serenity Prayer encapsulates a lot of the principles of management that Christians can employ in their day-to-day work as managers. Now, we are stewards. The Bible teaches us that. And right now, we have very special roles. You have very special roles as stewards, as managers. And you're a steward. You are a steward because somebody believed in you. But remember the parable, Jesus' parable of the stewards and their talents. God has given you responsibilities. He's given you abilities to carry these out. And he does have expectations. maybe being a manager is your calling. Maybe it's your calling for now. It might be your calling ultimately. You might be called to a higher level of management. You might be called to something else. But this is what you're called to do right now. So, with that being said, let us approach the job of management with gratitude and humility, and let us yield ourselves to God's will, guidance, work. Let us meet the challenges of administration with faith and confidence that God is with us to help us to accomplish His will. All right, we have a few minutes left, and I've rushed through some of the last points without giving you the opportunity to interject your thoughts and your comments and your questions, but I'd like to open it now for comments and questions, contributions of anything that you'd like to make. So the line is open.
Again, if you're calling in via phone, you can hit star six on your keypad. If you're interacting through your computer, you can unmute your microphone, or you can enter a chat comment or question in the chat feature on the left-hand portion of your screen.
Frank, there's a question from Shirley from Hillsboro, Missouri. Do you have any questions for working under a manager, micromanagers? Oh, that's a tough question. Many of us have done that. And I think the best thing I can offer at this point is just to do your job as best you can. Demonstrate to the manager that you have certain abilities and skills, and don't let it get under your skin. I assume that you mean is if you that you are in an administrative position right now and that you have a manager over you who's trying to tell you everything to do. That's tough, but I guess it comes with proving yourself over time. Truth of the matter is, though, you're probably not going to change that other person unless he has some kind of, or she has some kind of epiphany and realizes the error of their ways. But it's a tough situation to be in. But my suggestion would be to do your job with integrity and demonstrate over time that you don't need that kind of oversight, that you do have abilities and skills. Maybe in your evaluation, assuming that other person does the evaluation, the performance evaluation of you, if you in a positive way could ask for a little bit more ability, or not ability, but more leeway to make decisions and to do things without having to have others direct you. You'd have to choose your words carefully, of course, because if this person is micromanaging, there's a good possibility that she or he is a little insecure in their position. And so you'd have to choose your words carefully. But perhaps in evaluation, you could ask for more flexibility to make decisions and not have to be told by your manager what to do. Other thoughts?
Frank, I see another question from Heather in Dallas, Texas. The question is, how have you seen a difference between a church context versus an agency context in managing volunteers and committees?
Well, you certainly have more volunteers in church. Again, as Rick said at the beginning, a minister of a church is dealing with volunteers almost exclusively. You have a few church staff that are paid, but other than that, you're dealing with a plethora of volunteers. And you have volunteers in other kinds of agencies as well. And management of volunteers in any agency is always a tricky proposition, because you want to bring out the best in every person. You want to allow them to share their gifts in the best way possible, but by the same token, they can't just have free rein to do as they wish. There have to be regulations within which they operate, and certain structures within which they operate. And I'm not sure that volunteers and agencies that are secular and those that are church-related in that regard are any different. I think volunteers in any agencies, in any agency, can pose a challenge. But as I said, it's important, I think, for them to have a clear understanding of what their roles are and encourage them to give of what they can within the structure of the organization.
We hope that you enjoyed this training. Please remember to take the post-test and the course evaluation in order to receive your CEU certificate. If you have any additional input or questions, please don't hesitate to contact us at the information you can find on our main webpage or email us at info@nacsw.org. We hope that you will consider taking additional courses on topics sensitive to the thoughtful integration of faith, spirituality, and social work practices through our program. Thanks again, and thanks for supporting NACSW.